We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Doug Casey. He's the founder of Casey Research, author of several books, including Crisis Investing, Assassin, Speculator, and also the International Man blog. He also has a YouTube channel entitled Doug Casey's Take. How are you today, Doug?
Good. Very good, Tom. It's a pleasant summer day here.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're good, and it's good to speak with you again here. It's been a little while since we've had a chat. But, you know, Doug, I'd like to kind of center today's conversation around three of your books, and that's your fictional series starring Charles Knight. And I wanted to, you know, have a bit of a conversation about them. I think you did a great job in figuring out a way to really show how the world works through a fictional story. And I think a great way to, let's say, frame this conversation is to read a line from the book. And it goes as follows. Xander, Charles' accidental mentor in his erstwhile career as a speculator, was not one to judge anything based on legality or illegality. The qualifier, illegal, had little relationship to morality or to right or wrong. Laws crafted by politicians or regulators had at best an occasional or accidental relationship to morality. You could be sure that only the laws somehow benefited directly or indirectly the people that wrote them. So maybe we should start by asking the tough question of how a society should go about deciding what is moral or immoral and who the people are that should make those decisions.
Well, as you may recall, Tom, I'm what they call an ANCAP, an anarcho-capitalist. Mm-hmm. And my personal pilgrim's progress philosophically, when I was a little kid, I started out as a liberal. It's kind of an infantile philosophy, liberal in the current usage of the word. And later, I read Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative, and I figured that makes sense. I guess I'm a conservative. Then later on, I read Ayn Rand's book, The Virtue of Selfishness, and I realized that makes even more sense, because the good thing about Rand is she lays down a moral and ethical philosophy. And then, later on, I read the Tannehill's book, The Market for Liberty, and I realized that Rand hadn't gone far enough. That book, which I recommend to everybody, it's free on the internet, explains how society would work without a government. And it doesn't get into ethics and morality. But then again, politics is the practical application of ethics in a society, if you would. And at that point, I realized that the state itself was evil and destructive and unnecessary. And I know most people listening to your channel, if they don't actually believe that, are probably conservatives and traditionalists. That's fine. They're on the right side of the barricades. But I guess to answer your question is that it really is a question of right and wrong. It's a question of ethics and morality. And to me, the state itself is just the essence of evil and destructiveness. That's the real enemy. It's not a question of getting good guys in office, because it's like getting good guys to run the mafia. Maybe they're good guys when they come in, but you know, you swim in a cesspool, you're going to be corrupted. So all these books have as an undertone, a theme, the problems with the state. And I think if people think about it, that the state itself is concentrated coercion. And in the real world, we talk about right and wrong. One line you can draw between what's right and wrong is people that initiate violence and coercion and people that don't, that believe in a voluntary, peaceful relationship between people. And if you support the state, you're supporting the primary institution of violence and coercion in the world. That's kind of a long-winded answer, I know, but that kind of sums it up.
Well, feel free to be as long-winded as you want. Obviously, this is going to be a bit of a different conversation than the ones that we're used to having on the channel. And that's why I wanted to have you on to talk about some of these ideas, because I think it does go further into, you know, not just thinking about how to make money, but what we should be valuing as a society. So, you know, Doug, I'd like to ask you, you know, in another way here, if we think about where the lines of right and wrong should be drawn, I think a lot of people are going to have different ideas of where those lines should be drawn. So how do you think we should come up with a system of deciding who makes those lines?
Okay. I think that historically, those lines have been drawn from a moral point of view, as opposed to a legal point of view, by religions, priests, preachers, imams, whatever. And I don't think that that's the best way to do it. Because you've got these different gods that people worship. And people say, wait a minute, there's only one God, and he makes the rules. Well, I'm not so sure that's true, because the God of the Old Testament, one Yahweh, is pretty different from what most people believe is the God of the New Testament, Jesus. They have different rules, different ideas of what's right and wrong. And the God of the Mohammedans, whose name is Allah, he has a very different set of rules. So who's right? Can it be the same God? I'm not sure. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's not the same God. They're conflated together. Mm-hmm. And people say, well, okay, yeah, but we're Christians, most of us in this country, and Jesus laid down the rules of what's right and wrong. And listen, I'm very sympathetic to Jesus. I've got no problems with them. The problems that I have with Christianity, which has many different flavors and sects and subsects and cults and so forth, a lot of these, I think, arise from St. Paul, who most people are unaware, I think, never met Jesus, and went off on his own tangent, promoting a religion. So and then we can get into this whole thing of, well, can you prove that God exists, and has anybody seen him personally? I don't want to get into all that, because that's a hot button for people. You know, there's two things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company: religion and politics. And I guess we're going to talk about both of those. So, all right. So what kind of rules help you determine what's right and wrong, and how you could, well, if you believe in political rules, forget about religion for a moment, there are bookcases in front of them, thousands and thousands of volumes with, you know, you must do this, you must not do that, designating all kinds of crimes that will put you in jail. It's like this book by Harvey Silverglate called Three Felonies a Day. And just the average American, just in the course of living, winds up committing three separate felonies today. Mm-hmm. It's almost like we've devolved towards the Soviet Union, where, you know, Comrade Stalin asked Comrade Beria, the head of the secret police, about what they should do to prosecute this guy, some guy. And Beria said, "Comrade Stalin, show me the man and I'll show you the crime." So that's the problem with political laws. There are thousands of them, and nobody can know what they are. And most of them are stupid and destructive. And I guess, as I said in the opening quote that you said, they're made for the benefit primarily of the people that pass it. All right, so that's why people prefer religious laws, perhaps. You got the Ten Commandments. All right, that makes sense. But I question whether, we get about 50%, I question whether 20% of the population of the U.S. can name all Ten Commandments. I mean, you know, primitive people count 2, 3, many. It's hard to remember things past more than three things. Anyway, the Ten Commandments are problematical. So the way I see it, I'm answering the question of how do you know what's right and wrong? And I would say there are two great laws. And everybody can remember two things. One is do all that you say you're going to do. And the other is don't impinge on others' person or property. Well, any kindergarten student basically understands those things intuitively, really. But it's like, what is that, 17 words. And anybody can remember that. And that's all you really need to know. I mean, but I'd go further than that. I always like to take things to their logical conclusion. And I would say perhaps the whole of the law should be do as thou wilt, because people generally do what they want and they try to justify it. But let's put a colon in there. But be prepared to accept the consequences. And as long as you remember whatever you do, and you can justify anything and do anything you want. You can do anything you want, frankly. But be prepared to accept the consequences. And that makes people take responsibility for thinking things out and deciding, should I do this really or not? Is it going to have good effects for me or for other people or bad effects? And so I think the whole of the law is really just that. But since most people aren't terribly responsible, and that's do everything that you say you're going to do and don't impinge against other people or their property. That's all you need to know, frankly.
I was kind of thinking that, you know, in relation to other people, if you have a voluntary relationship, that seems, you know, a great place to start versus, you know, coercing somebody or having power over another person to coerce them into whatever it is that you want them to do. That seems like a good place to be able to kind of draw one of those lines, right?
Absolutely. And this is one of the Achilles heels of American society, especially the way it's oriented today, is that everybody looks at the state, the government, as kind of being a cornucopia, a savior, a teacher, an arbiter, somebody that's going to kiss everything and make it better and use their powers of force and coercion to make things right and make things happen the way I think would be good. I'll find the law that they have to enforce to punish those other people. And this leads to corruption and stupidity and destruction. So, well, the U.S. has been going downhill rapidly for some time. And the trend, its descent, is accelerating very rapidly at this point. It's gone into hyperdrive almost, where everybody is looking at the state to cure problems, to do things for them, to do everything. and it's going to result in a catastrophe.
You know, I cannot remember where I heard this, but thinking, you know, when we make laws, if you would be okay with the other party or somebody across party lines having that power at the end of that person's term, I think is a great way to think about how we need to look into the future in some ways when considering what laws we think should be enacted, what people should have less power, whatever that's going to be. So, you know, when we're thinking about the state in that way, I think that would put a lot of people back to actually thinking about the ramifications of some of those decisions.
Well, you're absolutely right, because you've got to look at the kind of people that go into government or want to go into government. And one way you can divide people is that you got people that like to control physical reality, you know, move atoms around, things around, create things, material world, constructive people. And then you got another kind of person that likes to manipulate people as opposed to material things, likes to boss other people around. And those people always are drawn to government, where once they get into it, they can force other people to do what they want. So that's why I don't look for good people to get into government and solve the problem, because government inevitably draws the wrong kind of people, just like Los Angeles draws gamblers, and Los Angeles draws wannabe movie stars. Government draws busybodies and controllers and manipulators, and they're immoral and destructive, and they should be, you know, kept out of social society as much as possible. They're dangerous criminal type personalities, I think.
Well, I think that brings up the bigger point that it's not necessarily the people that are the problem, but the system that attracts those people, right? If right. If they don't have the ability to control others through that, then it wouldn't attract those kind of people.
Yeah. So this is why if you read read the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution, the Constitution itself is basically, yeah, it's like a template for how you run a government. You know, the vice president gets to vote in cases of ties and the stuff like that, how you elect them. And those are trivialities. The most important thing in the U.S. Constitution is the Bill of Rights. And it never in the Bill of Rights says what the government must do. It's all about what the government cannot do. And the fact is that there's a clause in the main body of the Constitution called the Commerce Clause, where, you know, as a throwaway line, says, and the government shall, you know, enable commerce between the states or something like that. That sounds benign enough. But all these agencies, and we got hundreds of agencies, they're all economic. Most of them are economic in nature. You know, and that's where the problem is, because where money is involved, where capital is involved, and the government is regulating this, well, then the kind of people that get into government inevitably get their sticky fingers involved on that. So they distribute other people's money to their friends and so forth. So the government should have zero to do with commerce in a civil society. The government should, since it's a coercive entity, if you're going to have a government, I'll point out, should do nothing but protect you from other people initiating violence or force. That implies a military to protect you from force outside of the government's bailiwick, police to protect you from force inside the bailiwick, and a court system to adjudicate disputes without resorting to force. nothing to do with economics or money at all. Just defending you from violence. That's all it should do. And that's all initially was. Well, not entirely, because there were elements of corruption sowed in it from the beginning. But that's what it should be. That would solve all these huge problems that we're confronting in the U.S. today, I think, or most of them. Mm-hmm.
So, Doug, was it cathartic to write these books, you know, to develop these characters and have them act in such a way that many of us would expect, let's say, politicians or people in positions of power to act and show through the books of how many of these situations can work?
Yeah, it was. And I'm a big believer. I read a lot of nonfiction. I read a lot of fiction too, other people's. But the fact is that everybody, including myself, prefers to have a story rather than listen to a lecture. I like stories better than lectures. I think everybody does. So if you want to influence the way people think and the way they act, I think it's better to do it in the form of a story. So when John Hunt and I put together the series of novels, it's supposed to be a series of 7 novels that's tracing our hero, Charles Knight, through his life. And in the process, it reforms the unjustly besmirched occupations that he gets into, politically incorrect occupations. And as the series goes on, they're increasingly politically incorrect. Mm-hmm. And so he starts out as a speculator because, you know, as a kid, he's interested in making money. And, you know, he educates himself, learns about geology, and being interested in money and learning about geology, gets interested in gold and gold stocks, and gets lucky on a Vancouver gold stock with a property in Africa. And, you know, before he knows it, he's a kid that had no money and he's got $1 million on paper. So he goes to Africa and says, I better find out what this is all about, what happened here. And gets involved in a bush war with boy soldiers. And it's a great adventure tale, I think. Mm-hmm. And so one way or another, when we explain how this happens, he runs his $1 million fortune up into many millions and has the U.S. government, of course, steal it from him. And doesn't steal all of it from him, but most of it. And that leads to our second book, after he goes sailing around the world for 7 years, seeing the world on a sailboat, and he becomes a drug lord. And of course, drug lords are supposed to be horrible people with no redeeming characteristics at all. Well, that's not true. I mean, libertarians, and certainly myself, believe that everything should be legal. It's a question of personal responsibility. And I don't want to hear this bullshit about, oh, well, what about the children? The children are the responsibility of the parents. And this is a whole other conversation. Anyway, Charles becomes a drug lord dealing in both FDA-regulated drugs and DEA-regulated drugs and gets into trouble with both of those nasty and destructive agencies and develops a very interesting drug, kind of drug which, this is a sub-theme of the book, which most drugs, I'm all for legalizing them, but I think it's foolish to use most of them because they cloud your vision, cloud your views of reality and distort them. But he comes up with a drug that makes things clearer and improves your vision. And they really hate him for that, much more than any other drugs that he might be dealing with.
Because it ends up being so dangerous to the state because people can see through lies and see situations for what they actually are.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That makes it ultra dangerous, much more dangerous than things like heroin and cocaine, which are you know, whether they're good or bad, it's a question of moderation in all things. It's like tobacco and alcohol. You know, a little bit's okay. Too much, it's not good. So it's like that with any drug. But anyway, that's right. So Charles comes up with this drug, and they put him in jail. And that's the end. That's what happens in drug lore. I hate it's how he gets in jail. It's interesting. So I don't mind revealing that part of the plot. So at this point, and they steal his fortune again. So Charles is getting pretty pissed off at this point. And that leads us to our third book, Assassin. And the opening line in Assassin is that some people just need killing. And so Charles is a very ethical assassin. You think, well, you think an assassin's got to be evil. Well, no, he doesn't. And we explain the morality of the right and wrong of that. And assuming we get it done, the book we're working on now, we'll see if I'm so lazy, is called Terrorist. I have a lot of views on terrorism as a method of warfare. And everybody says, oh, terrorist, automatic evil. You're accused of being a terrorist. You're beyond the pale. Well, really? I mean, actually, terrorism is like an artillery barrage or a frontal assault or any other military tactic. Depends on how it's used and where. So then after terrorist, once you're accused of being a terrorist, you're in big trouble. So best place for somebody that's accused of terrorism to hide is a war zone. So where does he go? He goes back to Africa, where the first novel, Speculator, takes place, and becomes a warlord. And in the process, turns the shithole country of Gondwana into Singapore on steroids in a decade, which is quite possible. We can talk about countries where that's actually happened. So that's the next novel. Then the next ones after that, if they ever get written, get really radical. The next one would be called Antichrist. And the one after that, naturally, he's accused of being the Antichrist, needless to say. And then the last one is called Apocalypse, where things get really rather radical. So anyway, that's where I'm going with these things. And like Ayn Rand found, stories are the best way to present a point of view, much better than lectures or nonfiction, I think.
Yeah, you know, I don't read much fiction at all. I do a lot of research on nonfiction, trying to learn more. But, you know, just having something to be able to take my mind off of all of that serious business and have a story that really highlights a lot of the problems that we face nowadays, I think is really interesting. And that's why I asked if it was, you know, cathartic to have written these books, because a lot of the topics that you bring up in the book, like, let's say the corruption with most people in power, the questions about, let's say, the morality of charging, you know, 10 times more for a drug that is produced overseas by a generic company. And, you know, as a consequence, makes a family not be able to afford giving that to their child that might need it. I think those are really important topics that are really worth thinking about. And as you said, bringing it up through a story, I think is a really interesting way to have highlighted a lot of these lessons, Doug.
Yeah, you're quite correct, Tom, because fact of the matter is that people don't often talk about philosophy, and they don't actually talk about what's right and wrong. I mean, really, you talk with your friends or the man on the street or whatever, you know, you don't address these things because they're kind of hot button topics, or people feel that this is something that the preacher can deal with and tell me what to do or whatever. But it's actually very, very interesting.
Well, you bring up an interesting point by saying having somebody tell me what to do. Do you think that a lot of that comes from people, let's say, not having the confidence to make their own decisions and not wanting to take that? As you said, the key phrase that I keep coming back to is personal responsibility for their own lives, and just want somebody that they think, not know, think is qualified and knows better than them.
Yeah, and maybe they don't forget about know, and maybe even think isn't the right word. Maybe feel is a better description of it, because they don't even think about these things very much. They just kind of gut feel and react to these things. So it's a real pity, because the purpose of education, I think, should be to make somebody a responsible, moral being. I mean, absorbing knowledge is very important, but that's, if you're a responsible person, you'll absorb all the knowledge you can handle. The purpose of an education, classical education the way it used to be in classical times, is to instruct somebody, to help them to think out, you know, what's right and wrong, and the way that they should react with their fellow men, and the way they should live with themselves. Because after all, no matter what all these other people out there do, you still got to live with yourself. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you've got to have thought out these concepts of right and wrong and good and evil. So it's important you confront them. And in our society today, where if you just look at YouTube views as an indicator of what people are interested in, I mean, the Kardashians are, you know, much more important than almost anything. And when we look at the Kardashians, I mean, I think we're actually looking at stupid and degraded people that are interested and focus their lives among the most, you know, trivial things possible that just distract you from anything that's meaningful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all about clothes and cars and money. And it's nice to have lots of clothes and cars and money, but they're not really that important.
Yeah, that's something that I think the both of us are fighting an uphill battle against, is this attention economy and trying to help educate people that want this information or you know, should learn something about, let's say, how the monetary system works, how the Federal Reserve works, how the FDA works, any of these agencies, as you said, there are hundreds of them, how any of these things actually work, who they're run by, and how they affect people's lives. And I think
people don't think about these basics. If they think about money or economics, the most they want is a stock tout, you know, and they don't really, the average guy thinks the Federal Reserve is a part of the cosmic firmament, when probably is that not the case, but it should be abolished. And, you know, so we can go on and on about this.
So Doug, were these books inspired by any of your travels or any of the lessons that you personally learned and that you wanted to impart to people?
You know, they say that everybody's first novel is at least semi-autobiographical, and it's true. Mm-hmm. Obviously, although when I was just out of college, I thought about getting into the drug business, like a lot of kids do. And we've all thought about somebody that they'd really like to have shed this mortal coil, be assisted in doing so. But see, the nice thing about a novel is that you can say things and explore subjects that you can't easily do in nonfiction, frankly. That's the plus. And something that you write in the veil of fiction, it's much harder for them to put you in jail for. And the powers that be don't like thoughts that I'm coming across with in these books. So, sure, if they could, in this time where the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is being X'd out, yeah, there's a lot of things that they don't want to have said. So, that's what these novels are really about. And they're therapeutic for me, because some things just need to be said in public on a forum. And that's harder and harder to do today.
Well said, and I think, put into people's consciousness to be able to think about and discuss. And I think I know the answer to this question, but how badly do you think we need Sibylline or Naked Emperor right now?
We're in desperate need of it, among many other things in the country, because our civilization in America, there was no question that America used to be an exceptional country, because it was founded upon unique and exceptional concepts, but it's been degraded and has been going downhill for a long time. And now America is no longer number one. Except in the, people like to say that, some people anyway. It's turned into just one of 200 other nation states that cover the face of the globe like a skin disease. And that's really a pity, because it didn't used to be that way. Mm-hmm. And I decided to write these novels just because I felt that they needed doing, and it's good karma. They're not going to change anything. That's too mighty a task for anybody, unfortunately. But I just feel it's good karma. And I like to do good karma things. Mm-hmm. You got to live with yourself first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doug, I appreciate you coming back on to have a different discussion than usual for our channel. And of course, the name of the books again are Speculator, Drug Lord, and Assassin, in that order. And of course, those are available on Amazon, right?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And maybe the next time I'm back on, we'll be in the middle of a hopefully full-blown gold bull market, and we can talk about that.
Absolutely, Doug. Too. Thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Tom.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.